Welcome to the Free and Equal Network. Today I'm Christina Tobin, the founder of the Free and Equal Elections Foundation. We're here sitting today with Richard Melville Hall, also known as Moby. Moby is a world-renowned American singer, songwriter, and musician. He has sold over 20 million albums worldwide. He is known for his electronic music, his vegan lifestyle, and support of animal rights. So we're sitting here today at your restaurant. You're going to be opening up soon. It's called Little Pine.
In theory. That's what it's called now. I mean, we're not going to open until May. Mm-hmm. So I also have to say, like, these are the aesthetics as we've bought the restaurant. Mm-hmm. It might not necessarily look like this in a few months when we're opening.
We bought it last week, right?
We bought it like a few days ago. Wow. Yeah. So in theory, at some point in May, it will be open. And we'll look a lot different.
Well, congratulations. You're
thanks.
Definitely leading by example. You've been a vegan for 27, 28 years.
So I became a vegan. My vegan birthday was Thanksgiving 1987. Okay. And my math is not good. So I think that's, so it'll be 28 years the next Thanksgiving. It was 27 years last Thanksgiving.
Well, great. GMOs, really a great thing. Again, leading by example, non-GMO vegan restaurant here. Mm-hmm. Measure 92 in Oregon, the labeling of GMOs, the voters almost passed that. It was so close. And with you being pro-vegan and organic, what is your feeling about labeling of GMOs and more so how you feel spreading across the country and the success that you think voters will have?
Well, it sort of speaks to a couple of my interests. One is I've been a member of the ACLU since I was about 17 years old, and I just believe in transparency. So I don't know why labeling GMOs is an issue, because it seems like it should ostensibly be a constitutionally protected right. You know, like it's more freedom of expression than anything else. I mean, it speaks to my interest in organic farming and veganism and health, but it's also sort of an issue of freedom of speech and freedom of expression. And I find it very, very disconcerting how arbitrary and selectively and self-interestedly vested interests sort of either employ or avoid the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. You know, so like, how could it potentially be illegal to label something GMO? Like that's what it seems very un-American. You know, but then again, so does the ag gag bill. You know, all the ag gag bills are very un-American. You're familiar with ag gag, where it's like it's now, in some cases, a prosecutable offense to document the conditions on factory farms. Mm-hmm. You know, and so the whole it's for me, it's part of a disturbing trend.
Definitely, I couldn't agree with you more.
And also with GMOs, I am a college dropout who is a philosophy major. I'm not a scientist. So I don't know enough about GMOs to make sort of like broad, grand sweeping statements. Like I've had some friends of mine who are scientists say that, oh, in the poor and the developing world, actually some GMOs enable the cultivation of crops that are actually helping to feed people. I don't have an opinion, but that sounds like a nice thing. As opposed to the world of like Monsanto and Roundup, where they're modifying the genetic structure of organisms in the consequences of which we just have no idea. You know, so I mean, it serves the interests of Monsanto and ConAgra, but it seems like the potential to compromise human health for generations seems at the very least worthy of like taking a step back and evaluating it more.
Agree, and just labeling so we just know whether it's GMO or not, people can consciously make a decision whether they want to eat that or not.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the very sort of self-evident but odd thing is if Monsanto and big ag business, if they were super confident with GMOs, they wouldn't have any issue with them being labeled. You know, none of it makes sense to me. And the whole, like these, I mean, it's kind of remarkable in a way, like looking what happened in California and Oregon, you know, these bills that, or these resolutions that almost passed. Small, well-intentioned grassroots lobbyists going up against trillion-dollar corporations and almost winning. That clearly means that, like, the truth is on our side.
Integrity always rises in the end, and
In theory. Here's hoping. Yeah.
So moving on, and I'd love to connect you with David Bronner, Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps. He's a huge proponent for...
I've seen his op-eds in, like... he's written op-eds in the New York Times. It's sort of like... He's done, like, op-advertising, where it's like, you know, I've seen some, like, advertisements that are essentially op-eds.
He sponsored our fest last year. Mm-hmm. Great man.
And I've been... Dr. Bronner's soap. It's one of my earliest memories as being like 3 or 4 years old, because I was raised by hippies. You know, like being my mom taking me to a commune, being in a like the hippie commune bathroom, and like reading the soap label copy. I think they've toned it down a little bit because there was some nutty stuff on there. Like this was like the late 60s, early 70s, and they would list the things you could use Dr. Bronner's for, and one of which was birth control. I have a feeling they've removed that from the label copy.
So you seem like a spiritual individual. I know that transcendental meditation, TM, has been important in your life. Can you tell us a little bit more about it and how others may benefit through using this practice and maybe other practices you support as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm very resistant to any sort of dogma, especially if it's ostensibly an arbitrary dogma. And I'm not saying TM or other types of meditation are arbitrary dogma, but the world is such a complicated place. I feel like people should find a practice that works for them. So if someone tries TM and they love it and it resonates with them, by all means, do that. But if they try TM and it doesn't work for them, do something else. You know, the same way like some people love going to the gym and getting on a Stairmaster or an exercise bike, and some people like canoeing. They're both equally valid forms of activity, you know, of exercise. The same way TM or Vipassana or Zen or, I mean, there's so many different types of meditation, and I really do fully believe that, like, the meditation practice should serve the individual, not the individual serving the meditation practice.
You read my mind right there. I was just about to say it's based on the individual, and definitely I'm with you on that as well. And so I want to move into legalization of marijuana. There's been 23 states, that is, plus the District of Columbia, that has passed legalization of medical marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And 4 states have passed recreational use. I do feel Colorado is essentially at the forefront of this movement for legalization, for recreational movement. This really could have a strong effect on the prison system with pardoning.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about the timing of this?
Well, anything that basically decriminalizes consensual acts, I'm all in favor of. You know, like, the idea that, I mean, like, ultimately, I guess I'm a sort of a civil libertarian when it comes to our bodies. You know, so if someone wants to fill themselves with drugs, if someone wants to get tattoos on their face, if a woman wants to take control of her own health, all these things should be, like, sacrosanct, you know. And so the idea of punishing someone or criminalizing ostensibly a consensual act that only affects the person committing the act is, again, contrary to what I think this country should be about. So I'm all in favor of, like, I don't smoke pot. It makes me slow and stupid. But I do think what you're going to see, especially as, like, states are strapped for cash, and they start looking at the tax revenues generated in Washington State and Colorado, all of a sudden all the other states are going to be lining up to legalize recreational marijuana, not because they think it's a good thing, but because they simply think there's more tax revenue to be generated.
There's definitely an individual.
And, sorry to interrupt, but like, and when I was growing up, I had a few friends who ended up going to prison for the most minimal drug offenses, and it broke my heart. You have like these 19-year-old college students being shipped off to, you know, supermax prisons because they were selling some pot or mushrooms at a dead show. You know, and so they're like being bunked with rapists and murderers because they sold plant material. And that, I mean, there's so much about our judicial system and our prison system, it's horrifying, but that just seems like such an egregious wrong that's so easy to rectify.
Mm-hmm. Colorado. He really took a stance running as an independent for governor. His first biggest platform was if elected as an independent for governor, Mike Donovan, the mayor of Glendale, he would release everybody, pardon everyone that's in jail for marijuana for non-criminal offenses. So,
and again, like, there's so many different ways to approach doing the right thing. You know, like, one is that as a people, we can and should do better. I'm not running for office, even though it sounds like this is a campaign speech. But the other is the costs involved. Keeping a person in prison is so expensive. And again, it's all this public money that's being funneled to small corporations. And it defeats the public good, but benefits the small corporations. And the corporations hire the lobbyists, who then maintain the status quo. And the prison, prison reform is one of those exactly. Like, there are these privatized prisons that are making money hand over fist, but paid for by taxpayers. And the taxpayers naively think, oh, they're keeping violent felons out of the general population. It's like, no, they're, what about an 85-year-old guy who did something 50 years ago? He's not, there's no risk of releasing him. Or again, some kid who was guilty of selling pot at a concert. So pardoning and releasing people, it's the right thing to do. And would also save so much. I mean, literally, it would save billions of dollars. If every person in the prison population who had committed like a nonviolent felony was pardoned and released, taxpayers would save probably getting close to like $1 trillion. Which, of course, would bankrupt a lot of these private prisons, but I don't know. The broader good seems like it outweighs that.
Well, when accountability rises in our government, I think a lot of those things will fall in place, and I'll elaborate on that towards the end of the interview. Whistleblowers, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden. Can you speak about your support for WikiLeaks whistleblower Chelsea Manning and how transparency is contributing to the global awakening? And maybe a little bit on Assange, what your take is there with Snowden as well?
Yeah, well, it's hard to talk about and not just sound really self-evident, like to state the obvious, but like, and this is such a broad statement, but the truth is always a good thing. Transparency is always a good thing. And for the longest time, vested interests, both within government and on the corporate level, have done their best to sort of whitewash things or like operate in secrecy. Tyrants, dictators, corporate boards, they don't want the public knowing what they're doing, and their biggest fear is that the terrible stuff that they're doing will come to light. So when I see like anyone documenting injustice or documenting abuse, like they're a hero, and they're making the world a better place because they're shining a light on these sort of like dark recesses that the vested interests don't ever want anyone to be aware of. So that's why I, across the board, categorically support anyone involved in that work.
Yeah, thank you for your honest answer there. You are. I recently saw the documentary Citizen Four, Snowden, so that was an eye-opening thing, and transitioning into how documentaries such as that to John Stewart and Rosewater and putting truth, transparency out there. I'm kind of rolling into TV, media, sports, could be potentially a distraction, going right into the music industry, which is what you are in. It has been said by many major artists that once they are in contract with a major label, their artist expression can be limited. And so can you tell us, you have a long-standing history in the music industry. Can you tell us your experience and how this might be changed to allow for more artistic freedom?
Well, there are a lot of people who work for big record labels who are really well-intentioned, who really love music, who really want to do the right thing by the artists. But the way most recording contracts are structured, they're just awful. Financially, for example, and this is something that a lot of people might not be aware of, the way a recording contract works, like suppose if I run a record company and you're an artist, suppose I sign you and give you $100,000 to make your record. And then at some point, through record sales, you pay me back that $100,000, I still own your record. So it's kind of like a bank loaning you money to buy a house, you pay the bank back, and the bank owns your house. So the fact that artists, for the most part, don't own their recordings, even though they've been paid back countless times, it's it's so corrupt. And the fact that most musicians signed to labels don't have health insurance, whereas the people who work at the labels do. It's one of the reasons why, as the major labels fall apart, I'm not shedding any tears. You know, I'm sad for the good, well-intentioned people who lose their jobs, but the way the major labels are structured, and also the way in which they've inhibited creative expression, they've tried to, like, take idiosyncratic artists and sort of shoehorn them into more like a generic template. So when the major label, either the major labels have to adapt or die, you know, which is true for all of us on a daily basis. But if the major labels die, I won't be shedding any tears, because they've been terrible stewards of music. They've treated their artists terribly. They've treated their employees terribly. So it's hard to have too much love for the big major labels.
It's interesting you say how they sign the big money. Some could argue it's a bit of a compromise because whether your lyrics change or are not as strong or softly said. I find a lot of similar dynamics in, you know, the media, mainstream media arena, and how that influences our system. And of course, TV, reality shows, maybe no substance or little, to music and the lyrics. And also, it's interesting the price that you have to pay. And seeing a lot of artists essentially handcuffed, and I feel sympathetic for those who want to get released. I mean, there are some who maybe realize they made the wrong decision, and hopefully we can break through that and give the benefit of the doubt.
And I would say,
all of those artists,
even in our political system, like, I have a lot of friends who are elected representatives. They go to Washington with the best intentions, and they compromise a little bit here. And the reason for compromising is always expediency. You know, they think to themselves, oh, if I compromise on these five things, I'll get that one thing that I really want. The problem, then compromise becomes the status quo, and very few good things ever get advanced. And it becomes this culture of cynicism. And I think this is true for media, for politics, for everything, where people are just way too comfortable with compromise and being disingenuous. You know, because everyone in media and everyone in politics, when they present their case to the public, they'll never admit that they're compromising, even though that's what they do on a daily basis. And I think, I mean, I feel like new media is really good at shining a light on disingenuousness, you know, because in the old media, it was very monolithic, and I feel like people could get away with lying or misrepresenting themselves, and now that's simply... it's a lot harder for them to do.
And I definitely find that, you know, individuals like Russell Brand coming out about Fox News and really on one of his interviews stating how Fox, your days are numbered. I mean, it's just accountable media seems to be rising.
I actually in New York had a bunch of friends who worked for Fox News. Mm-hmm. The dirty secret of Fox News, almost everyone who works there is a Democrat. Like, meaning on the sort of administrative side. Like, my friends, they were not on-air talent. They worked in the back office at Fox News, and they were all left-wing Democrats who, you know, voted for Obama. And this one friend of mine who'd been there at Fox News for a long time, simply because it paid, like, in media, he was like, if he's going to be an account executive, why not be an account executive? Because for him, it's like he's just going to make money at his job, and he has a bunch of kids and mortgages and what have you. So he would work at Fox News because it paid well. But they would always have these conversations at Fox News, which was, their demographic is dying. You know, Fox News demographic is not being replaced. There aren't that many, like, 22-year-old, angry, anti-immigrant white people lining up to watch Fox News. It's their average age of their demographic is probably about 70, getting older, like, super angry, scared, belligerent white people. And they're all going to die. At which point Fox News hopefully will, or Roger Ailes, he's the one true believer there. And I think he's only kept alive by the fact that he hates everything. You know, like he's just this, like, weird sort of homunculus who's just fueled by rage. Like, he just hates everything. And at some point he'll die. And I think editorially Fox News will change quite a lot when Roger Ailes, you know, slips in the shower and breaks his neck.
Yeah. Positive direction. I'll leave it at that.
I thought you were going to say, here's to hoping he slips in the shower and breaks his neck. I was like, yeah, maybe he and, like, Clarence Thomas and Alito and, you know, some of the other Supreme Court justices could go on, like, a golfing trip and just find themselves in a lightning storm.
Yeah, you know? I just hope it just like great things rise and it's just simply replaced and mm-hmm. gradually fades out, you know, to the next generation. And really tying back into contracts, compromising, wanted to wrap up on, you know, towards the end of this interview, and people in office, I couldn't agree with you more, compromising is not an option, as it is what has gotten us where we are today. And respectfully so, the party system, it just doesn't work, you know, since the 1890s, they have controlled us through ballot access measures and election mm-hmm. fraud. And but before I hit that on the very end, I wanted to, you know, equality in office is a big one. You know, here at Green Equal Elections, and we all know that most of the people in office are of the male gender, both nationally and mm-hmm. globally. How do you feel this might be contributing to the imbalance on this planet? And how do you feel how more diversity, whether it's nationalities, gender, ages, might shift things?
I mean, I guess the first question is how that would be legislated or enforced. You know, affirmative action to representative democracy would be tricky. By definition, you can't really have both. What we can do, I mean, the world that we live in would become a million times better if simply there was a restriction of corporate money in politics. You know, I mean, I'm completely stating the obvious, but when someone's elected, they run as a man or a woman of the people, and the moment they're elected, they start working for corporations. And that's the agenda in Washington is just driven by corporate lobbyists, which we accept, but other countries, that's not the case. So I, institutionally, because I feel like the United States is this vast melting pot, and the melting pot is not reflected in Washington or in state legislatures, so there are a few things we could do that would make sort of politics resemble the world in which we live. One, make voting days a national holiday.
Yes.
You know, that's the case in other countries. Have penalize people if they don't vote. Simply, there's a financial penalty if you don't vote. If 100% of eligible voters voted, you would see a very different demographic. You know, the people who vote are, it's like if you look at the curve demographically, statistically, it tends to be old, angry white people, you know, which is why every midterm election, for the most part, the Republicans win, because the rest of us have jobs, you know. So if the voting is happening, you know, if your precinct is open from 7 a.m. to 4 p.m. or 5 p.m. or 6 p.m., who's going to go on a Tuesday? You know, not, you know, the parents who are trying to like balance work, child, career, etc. It's going to be retired people, you know. So you look at, like, I mean, like, I remember there was one midterm election where like the Republicans were like, we have a mandate to govern. I was like, 25% of eligible voters voted. How is that a mandate to govern? You know? So that's the first thing, is like simply get everyone to vote mm-hmm. and to step back and watch the demographics change. You know, another, and I don't know why this hasn't happened, let the citizens of Washington, D.C. become a state. You know, let them, they don't have representation. They have an observer in the House. Who cares? You know, let them have two senators and let them have a representative in the House. There are more people live in the district than live in Wyoming. So imagine, or simply take away federal representation for Wyoming. You know, the district doesn't have it, why should Wyoming have it? You know?
Well, it seems like the key to making all these things happen really is getting accountable candidates, mm-hmm. primarily independents elected into office. Seeing,
I mean, I'm not
independent-minded, accountable.
Yeah, I'm not personally. I think structural reforms are more important. Like Democrat, Republican. I mean, clearly Republicans are. I mean, the ways in which, the only way Republicans win is by keeping people away from ballot boxes. Or rather, keeping almost everybody except for angry white people away from the ballot boxes. Like, you look at what, I mean, first off, one thing that has always seemed so strange and only the product of our founding fathers is the fact that federal elections are administered by state attorney generals. That's just weird, you know.
Which are appointed to office.
By the Republic.
People, these and ours alike.
Yeah, and so when you had that system in Florida in 2000, where like the election was being overseen by a Republican attorney general who'd been appointed by Bush's brother, you know, and then it was, I mean, basically we sat through a coup, you know, it was just a coup that was done in public, and then the Supreme Court, who'd been installed by Bush's dad and Bush's dad's ex-boss, they all like certified the results. So it was a coup. You know, you can't say when one person gets a million more votes and is kept from occupying the office, it was a coup. Any other country would be very clear. But we all just sat back and watched American Idol. Yeah.
And so an individual, inspirational individual once said, if you want to ever bring about a revolutionary, I like to drop the R and say evolutionary change, two things would need to be involved, the youth and music. And hence, we're holding our second United We Stand Festival in Colorado. This summer, we've got a couple of venues, but I think one very much will be likely where it will be held. And so on that note, the fest is about making voting exciting again and fun. You know, we worked with headcount.com last year, Rock the Vote, and getting people to not only want to vote again, but to run for office, to get engaged in the electoral process, to create a platform that opens it up for musicians that are not watered down by contracts, who can sing the music they would like, speak their mind, from yourself to Michael Franti, to the Montes Yahoo, to Wyclef Jean, different genres of music coming together, from large, mid, lower artists to intellectuals, leaders, to the John Stewarts or the Russell Brands. It doesn't matter, just people that need to be heard throughout the world. And so I definitely will pass along the information, but I wanted to personally give you some information
about
free and equal elections.
Thank you.
And we'll be addressing electoral fraud, you know, the need to, maybe there needs to be changes. Is the Electoral College popular vote good for us? Should we implement instant runoff voting, proportional representation, those sort of things?
There's another thing that has, because I was a philosophy major, and there's this fallacy, there's a philosophical fallacy, it's called the is-ought fallacy. And it's fallacious logic to say that because something is, it ought to be. For example, one could have argued, and people did try and argue, in the early 20th century, because women haven't been allowed to vote, they shouldn't be allowed to vote. Because kids work in factories, they should work in factories. Because slavery exists, it should exist. You know, like these are, it's so clear when we see this fallacious logic, how it should be overturned. But one thing that I've been very confused by is like representative, like having elected representatives. We just accept like, oh, that's the way it works. It's the way everything works. We're all pretty educated at this point. You know, I don't know if we need to have professional representatives in the way that we did 200 years ago. You know, 200 years ago, a primarily agrarian populace who didn't really know, like, and Washington was like a month away. Now, it's safe to say that the general public is better educated than most politicians. Why do we still let them make all the decisions? Why, like, we know how to vote online. You know, everyone's connected, so why not have true representative democracy where issues are voted on by the people?
Not by paid corporate stooges, you know, who pretend to be ostensibly representing the will of the people. So I really feel like that has to be the future. You know, instead of like paying like overfed white guys to go to Washington, wear bad suits, and vote for their corporate masters, we vote on a, you know, a weekly basis, a monthly basis, where it's like when issues come up, not all of them, but like a lot of issues that are before Congress could actually be dealt by the populace directly.
And our freedom is essentially the internet. You know, we have that freedom, and I'll tell you a little bit more afterwards. We're launching our initiative, The Election Assistant, which will list every single candidate running for office, whether they're D, R, independent, incorporating online debates, because we have a history of doing lots of debates, as well as the money of politics. I foresee that fading away and accountability rising.
I hope so. I mean, Citizens United was such a, it was just a dark moment in the history like of our country. Say the corporations are people, but we don't have to know what they're doing. And they're allowed to contribute whatever they want to the political process. Like, that is so insidious.
Well, I hope you can make it. Looks like it's going to be September 12th through 13th in Colorado. And I thank you, Moby, for your time today. Did you have anything else to say to our listeners out there?
No, not that I can think of.
Well, Moby.com is his website for those of
I
you.
Mean, I guess the one thing I would say that what I've been really surprised by is how many progressives eat meat. I'm really baffled by this because, like, according to the United Nations, 25% or more of climate change comes from raising animals. It takes roughly 100 gallons of water to make a pound of soybeans and 10,000 gallons of water to make a pound of beef, not to mention the animal suffering, the communities that are decimated by slaughterhouses. I'm really, truly baffled when you have progressives who still, like, every time you buy a hamburger or milk, you're contributing to the system that you loathe. And you're the use of natural resources, the deforestation, the water pollution, the climate change, the way communities are ruined. So like a progressive eating meat or dairy is akin to like someone at a cancer organization smoking cigarettes.
Mm-hmm. It seems like every problem we have again derives from a flawed electoral system and having the desire to have
and personal accountability. I mean, I feel like we do still live in a democracy, and politicians and corporations will respond to us if we speak up. You know, if en masse, like, for example, the fact that women are so underrepresented in Washington, women should boycott that.
And worldwide.
Yeah, and worldwide. Like, women have so much power, like, just stop voting for male politicians.
Well, thanks for your time today. It's delightful to speak with you. I'm so glad to have met you, and your team is so wonderful.
I look forward to
connecting with you again in the future. So that's a wrap. You're on the Free Nicole Network today. We're with Moby. Thank you for your time, a man that leads by example in every way, and hope you join us again. Thank you so much.
Dr. Bronner's Magic Soap is the number one selling brand of natural bar and liquid soap in America, Japan, and Korea. A bottle of Dr. Bronner's is sold in the USA every 3.5 seconds. Experience it for yourself.
Sure, voting's a hassle. Getting registered and then making time to vote. But between golf clinic and lunch at the club, I vote. Because only educated people with life experience should be voting. Not kids who think they know everything. Laws making it harder for riffraff to vote? Absolutely. Keeps things as they should be.
First thing you do is ask a question, what's needed? and then provide the opportunity. What do people really want? They want camaraderie, opportunity, a place to live, a feeling of family, a community.
Thank you.